2019-2020 season. It's the fifth year we have our public astronomy lectures, and that's actually cause to celebrate. We have an interesting lineup this year, starting with Dr. Werner Olvera. He will tell us something about dust in galaxies and overlapping galaxies. And the next talk, which is in November, it will not be in October since we have the Bullet Lecture every year at the University of Louisville. So we spare the October, but that will be by Dr. Chris Craney. And that will become an interesting talk, an amusing talk. So I'm looking forward to that one. It will be about the Star Wars universe and how it is on the wrong side of history. So I hope you find time to come to all of the talks. So far we have scheduled until April. It's always the first Wednesday in the month, except for January. January's first Wednesday is on 1st of January, and I did not want the good people of Monique to give us this room for free to come in after they had a big New Year's Eve party here. So we give them a day off and do it the week after, so it will be the second week of the month, so second Wednesday. So I hope you enjoy this season, and we have a good discussion. And we start with Dr. Olvera.
Hi. All right. No microphone, so shouting is involved. I'm Werner. Dr. Holbert always feels like my dad. I'll talk about overlapping galaxies. So I'll talk about serendipity and accidental things happening. And I'll tell you first why I do this. This is hammered into me by my professors, always at the beginning of the talk, tell your audience why you're doing this in the first place. Maybe they'll hang on to it till the end. Here we go. So I want to make the dust forecast. I want to be your a forecaster, a weatherman, if you will, for people who study galaxies. And so my two questions are: if I'm here, so suppose I'm interested in a little bit of a galaxy, I want to know how much dust is there, how much light am I missing because there's this like fluffy stuff floating around. It's like smog, really. It's like the stuff that comes out of a badly tuned car. And it's basically coming out of a badly tuned star. That's really what's happening. And it's the brown stuff that you occasionally can see between the stars, kind of a little backlit. And so what are the chances there's some dimming, and what are my odds of reddening, maybe discoloring what I'm looking at? So those are the two things that I'm interested in. Yet, how do you do that? Well, the trick for me was you get lucky, and you get two galaxies where one doesn't know about the other one, but it just happens to be in front of the other one, where you see lots of these little dusty, dark brown streamers, and that's the thing that we study here. So it makes a really pretty picture, because, you know, there's two galaxies and you see in their full glory, but these two galaxies don't know about each other. One is just happens to be further than the other, and they just happen to be along the same line of sight. So you have to really look out for everything to neatly line up like that. Fortunately, the universe is a very, very big place, so if you need to be lucky, then you just look at more universe, and you'll eventually hit every rare thing in there. I've been looking, and with the help of many others, for this kind of thing, where there's a bright galaxy in the back and there's a galaxy in front, so that I can study the fuzzy brown stuff there. So I don't care about the stars, I care about the weird stuff that you see there. So if you look at a galaxy, a typical galaxy is made out of about 10 to 30% stars, something like 70% dark matter, and there's like a little bit of gas in there, and then less than 1% is the dust. So the actual dust doesn't contribute a lot to the actual mass. If you bake a galaxy, then you only need 1% dust, but it does a lot to the starlight that you see, because it dims and reddens. There we go. So me and Bill Keel have been working on this. This is one of Bill Keel's pictures. There's a galaxy on the edge here at the back, and then at the front you can see the whole structure of the foreground of the galaxy as it has, like, all these fluffy red things. But as soon as it is no longer backlit, because of a trick of the eye, you start seeing the starlight of this galaxy again. But you know that it has all these dark planes inside of it. Right? So it kind of reveals something by its absence. So we're looking for the dimming and then also the reddening, because just like a sunset, if you have a nice smoggy atmosphere, if you're living downstream from a coal plant or something, then you have very pretty sunsets because they're all quite red. So that's exactly what's happening here. And so we've been looking for these accidental overlaps there ever since, because we kind of don't want both galaxies to not know about each other. If they start interacting, if they start pulling each other apart, then they're not a normal galaxy anymore. And, well, you know, while that's pretty cool, I don't want to look at those. I want to look at ones that are otherwise perfectly normal, just happen to have a bright light behind them. Again, if I point it. So this is another one that I quite like. These two are interacting, so they are currently tidally stripping each other. But they just got started, so all right, fine, they're giving a pass. So this is when we look at it from the ground. You can see the dust already a fair bit. So we can do this with ground-based telescopes, but it's always better to go to Hubble. So we took a picture of Hubble from this there. And then you see all the detail. I mean, you can come up right close, I can blow this up even further. There's all these little fluffy streamers in there. And so we're following that, just how far out does it go? Is it in the arms or is it between the arms? How much of it is there for any kind of galaxy? And as a bonus, we get really pretty pictures. So I may have gotten into this because of the pretty pictures. Now, the dust takes light away from the stars, right? So it absorbs, but it then doesn't, you know, hold on to it. It basically re-emits it as heat, as exactly the kind of heat that you feel from, like, a furnace or anything like that. So, if we look in heat at the exact same pair, look, there is your dust, right? So, one of the tricks is to go look at where we're missing light and see if we actually see the dust glow if we're looking at it in the Spitzer. So this is the Spitzer picture, and it kind of transitioned rather quickly. So there we go. So this is the Hubble picture, and as you then go to the Spitzer picture, you can kind of see that you can follow these dark lanes over here, or this one over here, and this is then. Listen. All right. Low tech. You can see that those light lanes start lighting up as the dust now glows and re-emitting that light that it was earlier. So how do I find these things? Well, apart from a guy in the pub told me, which is how we got started, right? You just have all your friends and astronomy friends and you say, hey, I'm really interested. If you see one of these, you know, tell me about it. We thought we'd ask more people, and so this is the Galaxy Zoo. It's an online project where anyone can come help astronomers identify weird stuff. I mean, the official title is a little different, but I just kind of keep it under the header, weird stuff. And it means that you see pictures of digital pictures of our universe, and you get to classify what's in there. And the neat part is that sure, we did all kinds of different projects with them, and one of them, Bill Peel here, just casually mentioned that he would like some more overlapping galaxies. Never say anything casual to a whole bunch of enthusiastic nerds, I can tell you that. Because we moved from, I moved to my low-tech wax solution. So what you do is, you get a picture and you say, this is an elliptical, I see it's interacting, or if it's a spiral, then I see this many spiral arms. So you individually only answer a few questions. But the thing is, there's a lot of you, and all of you are answering questions, and asking the same question for the same galaxy. So we get a consensus. We don't get like, well, this guy said that it has a spiral arm, so I guess it has a spiral arm, right? That was the level where we were at before then. But now we have, like, majority vote says spiral arm. Too bad, minority. So actually is very indicative in some like really good classifier, because you can start realizing that some of these people are really good at this, right? So if there's a minority report on this that says maybe this is something else, then we also look at that. But you can do really interesting things with that. Also, you can ask everybody to say, like, hey, if you see an overlap, let us know. That would be really neat. But the main goal was to classify. So classify, these are elliptical galaxies, and now as you go flatter and flatter, these are bar spiral. We have, like, an elongated. We're in a bar, so I feel like I need to mention bar galaxies here. And so you get bar galaxies, and you get non-bar galaxies, and then you've got, well, the first category of weird is irregular, which is just a giant bin of it's none of these. Hubble's original classification, but that's what we ask the volunteers to definitely do. So every we get votes on how many of these things are, if you see a galaxy, how many votes are for elliptical, how many are in favor of it having a bar. It gets pretty good, but then you can also look at all the other stuff, and that's really neat, because now we suddenly don't have like one or two, but we have many. So mergers, look at all these train wrecks of galaxies here, they've been smashed together, and they have like tidal arms stripping out, or like this one, and this one, like it's been looped all like spaghetti, or I don't know how you make spaghetti, but I assume that it's similar to that galaxy. And then you can have rings, like for instance, this galaxy goes this way, but it has a ring going the other way. Or for instance, what happened to this guy, right? If there's a little galaxy in between, there's a ring around it. And you have these overlaps that we've asked for, and you see weird spiral patterns. Like, for example, some galaxies have three arms. Not two arms, not four arms, three arms. And it turns out there's a lot of these as well. So you get to learn a lot by engaging everyone else. You know, you can go quite far if you get more people on board. So merging galaxies, I have to throw this in because we're trying not to get deep, and you can kind of see why, because it's hard to figure out where one galaxy ends and one of the other begins, right? Because they are literally smashing into each other. And so these are the ones that we're not trying to look at, but again, we found a whole bunch of them, and so now we can study how train collisions or galaxy collisions work. And we saw lots and lots of overlap. And remember, this was not an official classification. This was not a button that you could push. These people had to go into the little chat room that went with it and say, yeah, I found an overlap in here. And the funny thing is that we thought, well, we'll get a dozen or so. Maybe two dozen. Yeah, we got more and more, and it just kept streaming in. At some point, we had 2,000 of these. So I'm still catching up with this Galaxy 2 effort to get to classify and see how we do with the little adjustment. So happy birthday, Galaxy Zoo. This has been going on for quite some time. I love this completely frivolous application of this. You can type things out in galaxies now. You can give yourself a post-describing galaxy. So what do you do? You've got these galaxies, you've got these overlaps, you then go to Hubble Space Telescope and go, like, right, I want a good picture of this. Like, ground base is all not well and good, but I want a really pretty picture. But because it's the Hubble, you can only take one picture in one color at a time, so they're all black and white for now. And so you can start seeing that we see lots of these little, like these dark streams, and we're trying to identify where we see the dark streams, how much of them we see, and we see some really strange things, like for instance this one over here, I'll blow that up, we were looking at these two, and kind of hoping to see some dark lanes over here, but this is a tiny little galaxy in front of it, and it has a ring of dust around it, so that's odd. Small galaxies are not supposed to do that. So that's a new one. And we have this one, which I think is the prettiest, and fortunately everybody else agrees with it. We are getting more data on this one. But here's an elliptical galaxy, here's the spiral. What I love about it is that you can see the spiral arm, and at some point the spiral arm becomes this dark thing. So spiral arms are made of stars that have dark stuff inside them. And that's dusty dark stuff goes all the way out to here. So if you have a galaxy like this and you kind of look at it without this galaxy behind it, you'd never think that dust would be this far out. So you look at that in detail and you can see these dark lanes go all the way out, and they're clumpy and they're made out of these filaments. And so, yeah, I want to go see, please don't tweet this or put it on social media just yet. Because we got some more Hubble time on that, and so these blue parts are where new stars have started to form, and these dark lanes keep going, so the dark lanes and the new stars know about each other, and we're looking at how those two correlate, right? This is the first time we can actually follow the dust around in extreme detail and watch where it turns into bright blue stars. Also, because it's such a pretty pair, this is a prime target for the James Webb Space Telescope. It is supposed to go up 2021 now, March 2021, I'm assured, but this has happened a couple of times now. It's all bolted together now. It is ready to go to French Guiana and get launched, so I am in good spirits about the chances of actually launching in 2021. Also because it's a year and a half away, and so I think we're in good odds, and so we'll actually take a James Webb, one of the earliest pictures, will feel that overlapping pair that I just showed you. So we'll have an even prettier picture to show the show off that this guy works, if it works. Kind of crossing every finger we have. Same thing here, this is just off the Hubble, so we see these little overlaps and lots of these bridges of dust and gas as this little galaxy in front of this big spiral, and so little galaxies turn out to have lots of dust to far out radii and hidden, swirled away where you think otherwise would be dark. Kind of working with a delay, it's very annoying. So this is another one of the most recent ones we see, this stuff over here. So these things have just come off the Hubble, so hence they don't reach it yet. Just give my grad students a little bit of time to actually finish the analysis so that we can go, you know, make a big blah about it. Alex Jackson will write a paper on this. Very good remote, it only works when we're right here, so so how do I analyze this? So I'm told that you should never show a bit of a math problem, but I think you can handle this part. What I'm looking at is I'm looking how much light I'm seeing on the far side of the foreground galaxy, in the overlap, or at the foreground galaxy, the background galaxy dimmed by a bit, and here's the background galaxy on the far side of that. And if I say, like, well, let's assume that both galaxies can be flipped with immunity. Basically, I can rotate them. And if I do that, I can turn them into, like, well, this is 50 the same then, and so then move them around a little bit, and I've got an expression for how much dust dimming I should see. So from one image, I can find out how much dust there is. And if I do this in multiple colors, then I can actually see how much retinue there is, how much it dims as a wavelength. So, for example, we take our, like, you know, I love this galaxy, obviously. this is a Hubble picture. The reason that you're seeing all these stars here isn't because we're looking through the Milky Way. The reason that you, there's not even a Milky Way star on this picture. We're looking through an entirely different galaxy, and all those stars are from NGC 253. We just happened to catch this one while Hubble was looking at that other galaxy. So these are stars in a different galaxy. Those little red dots are even further away galaxies. So whenever I think of this picture, whenever I see this picture, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Astronomy is a windshield science. Whatever I on the travel there, it just got stuck to the windshield, and that's it, right? So you get everything smacked together, which is great because these two are, you know, smacked on there. But also these stars are from a completely different galaxy. That's why this is right at the edge of the picture that we were taking. a little to the left and we would have never known about it. Right? So you gotta get, luck is a big part of it, I will admit, straight up. So we got, a friend of mine came up to me and said, hey, I hear you like overlapping galaxies. I'm like, well, I can't find Bill, but could you do something with this? And yeah, then I was off to the races. So this is how that works. And so if you then look at that part that has the dust, if you look at it as very blue, for example, it becomes very sharp and very clear, and if you go to the red, it becomes fuzzier and harder to see. So in the red, it lets more light through, and in the blue, it scatters and stops it better. And it's like, okay, so we've got a blue picture, a green picture, and a red picture. How do those compare? Well, I got blue and red here and green over there. These are all points and all pixels in these three maps, and I will have a look at how much, if I make the green dimmer, how much redder did it become. And the black dashed line is what I measured, the red dashed line is what we've seen around Milky Way. So this is pretty much the same stuff. Kind of didn't know that. Right, so we've assumed that our Milky Way is a good template for the rest of the universe. It's kind of like meeting one person and going like, well, that's all of humanity sorted. I know who this is. So I kind of want to figure out if the stars make the same stuff in all the galaxies. I kind of want to figure out if this works the same way. So if the stars run just as badly in this galaxy as they do in like the Milky Way or bigger. And so, yeah, the reddening of that seems to be pretty consistent with our Milky Way. And so, I'm looking for more of these. I'm working with the Galaxy News still. We're still adding to the catalog pretty much every day. They now have added a button. I am so excited. Version 4 of the Galaxy Zoo has a button that says, is this an overlap? So really, we don't even need to hashtag it or anything. It just goes, boop, yes, is it an overlap? So we will go make another catalog and we go find out what's happening. I want to know if big galaxies only have all the dust, or small galaxies have a lot of dust, or their size. How far out does it really go? Because, you know, it seems to off, but I don't know because it's dark over here and I can't see anymore. And that's annoying. If only that galaxy would shift up a bit so that I can see. But it won't for another few billion years, so we're stuck with it. And so I want to see how it then glows and how it regurgitates the light back at us. So I want to kind of balance the budget for a typical galaxy. So, yeah, I'll leave you with the pictures. I love the pictures. Sorry, I'm leaving on that picture, so if you see it again, then that's the end of the talk. What we want to do is figure out if that reddening, so this is wavelength, and that's the amount of reddening. Really what we did is take the same picture in multiple colors, and this is in the ultraviolet, so as you go into ultraviolet, which is over here, the models for dust start to really differentiate, so we can see if it's Milky Way all the way through, everywhere, or if it's like modulating cloud dust, or who does what. And I haven't even touched this yet, but there is this weird bump over here. We have no idea what does that. So there is, this dust is made out of carbon molecules. It's literally what, you know, cigar smoke kind of stuff, fine particles, some little bit of fine dust thrown in for good measure, so Sahara dust blowing in after the coal plant. But what exactly does this? We have no clue. And I'm curious if all galaxies have that bump or not. Like, let's see if that's there. So, what are my chances of dust thinning? Is one I want to kind of give to all the other astronomers. And what are my odds of reddening? And how will it redden? Those are two questions I want to answer. And then, does it go back and forth? Or
Once,
okay. Sorry, animation is not my thing with this yet. So that was my reason for getting overlaps. I'm getting more, talk to me about these, but I love these rare beasts and where to find and how to find them. So I'm gonna give it a chat. Eight and a half an hour and I talked to you. Questions?
Real elementary one. Hmm? What causes galaxies to take a different shape than shown in the classification, and how are they different based on their shape?
That's not, well, it's an elementary question. It's a hard one. Elementary ones are hard. The things that, everything that looks like a pancake looks like that because it's spinning. It's very much like tossing a pizza. It becomes flat because it spins very, very fast. The football-shaped ellipticals are more because basically two galaxies crashed into each other and nothing spins really anymore. Everything is just chaotic orbits for these stars. So the main thing is we get a disk because it rotates, and we get a football because it smashed, its two galaxies smashed together. So that's the main difference between the two.
And why do they behave differently?
They do, so the pancakes, the flat ones, still form stars. They still have a lot of gas, so they're bluer. They have young stars are blue. The elliptical basically burned through all their gas already, so they only have old stars, which are reddish and orange. So that's why they look reddish and orange. Fundamental question, still not figured out where bars come from, so, you know, don't ask.
You mentioned the Magellanic Cloud. Is the dust and then different than in the Milky Way?
It is. They don't have the bump.
Okay.
No idea why. So, you know, it's our Milky Way has the bump of various strengths. It seems to be that the bump, there's a little evidence that the bump is also in other Milky Ways, like big spirally galaxies. This little less small Magellanic Cloud has a curve exactly like it, except that there's no bump. Completely different chemistry, maybe a different composition, maybe different. You need a really big star to make the stuff that makes the bump or something. It's a big mystery how to make dust in the first place and how to keep it around, because if you have a strong UV light, right from the young star, that burns it off. If you have a HVAC system, for example, and I know this from experience, the HVAC guy will sell you a filter that's based on a UV light, which essentially zaps everything that goes through the filter. Slightly ionized air will come out of the other end, and that's what they use in hospitals. And if they sell it to you like they did with me, then they will also do that in your house. That's actually a very good way to clean your house, but it does mean, like, well, if I've got these bright UV lights hanging around everywhere, what happens to the dust? It should break already. So it's a weird, like, how do you make it and how do you keep it around? Sorry, was that too quick? Questions? Yes.
So, are you studying the physics of the dust itself, or are you, like, trying to get its properties filtered out from behind it?
So I like to know where this is coming from and where it is. Like, it's a very simple, like, where it is question. I then want to go and be useful to other astronomers and say, hey, this is how you can get rid of it, which is really what 90%, 99% of the astronomers are after. Right, they just want to get rid of it, it's an annoyance, it's a, they kind of want to put the wipers on and just get rid of it altogether.
Right. I guess one comes first. You got to know
where it is. And so one of the big pushes has been to figure out where exactly it is and how much light it takes away from the young stars and from the just formed stars, so that you can actually see how many young stars there are. It's a really hard question, actually, to answer if there's, like, a haze in front of it. Right? You were trying to squint here, and so that's why. Okay, more questions? Yes.
So you had the color plots, and the Milky Way was a dashed black line, and the one you were looking at was the red one. Do you have a large enough sample to have some sort of distribution as to how far the red line gets away from the Milky Way, or...?
Yeah, not with that one. That's something that Alice is hopefully going to do with the other galaxies that I showed. I showed a three color, but we have multiple colors on those. So we can go to the ultraviolet and we go to the near infrared. And so hopefully we'll see if that actually is a common line or not. What exactly that slope is not sure. It'd be interesting. I like all good astronomers, I'm running behind behind my data. I have more of these pairs than I can actually work with, and I now have more Hubble time than I actually can analyze as fast as I can. So I'm now a little behind on everything, but you know, like a rabbit out of Alice in Wonderland. So
how did you end up on this subject?
Well, a misguided thesis, I guess. So, as a PhD student, I did the other thing. I did the logical method. Let's see if I can find a good one. I need a nice written. So, this is a nice deep picture. This is a background galaxy that knows nothing of these things. There's another background galaxy. If you look up close, there's all these little fuzzy things. They're very distant galaxies, like hundreds of times more distant. They're almost a uniform screen behind these galaxies. So somebody decided that this would be a great grad student project to go count these things and then figure out how much we're missing because of the structure in the foreground galaxy by simulations and then counting them again, and then dimming those simulations a little bit and then counting them again. Basically count background galaxies until you're blue in the face. And I volunteered. So, yeah. So I did that method for various HST images. It gets fiendishly hard to find these background galaxies. It works great on a little bit of a distance because there's no foreground galaxy anymore. But as soon as you put some rich structure of the foreground galaxy in front of it, you're kind of squinting at that, going like, could be a background galaxy for most of your early PhD. So I figured it out or calibrated it reasonably well, got it to a point that it sort of worked, published the results, and realized that this was way better. So, okay, we'll put it to bed. This is a much better technique, especially if you have more than one galaxy. If you have more than one pair, you can just say, all right, fine, maybe I don't know exactly because of the background galaxy, may have some structure in it or something. That's fine. I got 2,000 more of these things. I'll go check with the other 2,000 now. So that works way better. It's great when your PhD project gets killed in the same time frame that you do it, but I got my PhD out of it, so that's fine.
Don't you wish that you could have had the galaxy do type or the source extractor for dummies?
I will say another story. So when I was doing my PhD, one of my supervisors wrote a paper, and she said, right, you'd think that Andromeda would be a great place to do this because, you know, it's a huge galaxy in the sky, bigger than the moon on the sky. And so if you look for background galaxies in there, you get loads of them, you can make a good map. So background galaxy searches in Andromeda would be fantastic, except nobody's crazy enough to do all of Andromeda with the Hubble Space Telescope because that would take forever. So it's kind of funny how sociology comes into this, right? So the way we distribute Hubble time is basically we ask a panel of white people, is this a good idea, yay or nay? Most of the time the answer is nay, because we only have so much time in this very expensive thing. But our implicit assumption was that nobody's going to do Andromeda. That's just crazy talk. Well, J.D. hadn't heard of it, Julianne Del Canton hadn't heard that, and she went like, fine, I'll just go do it. It'll take 667 orbits, which is 667 hours on Hubble, considering that Hubble takes about $2,000 per second to run. That's a sizable investment. But this came from the fact that as a Hubble community, we kind of went like, what's the thing, like we had a couple of near misses with Hubble, right? It kind of threw a cog and then a couple of astronauts went up and fixed it, right? Four times in a row. Now no more astronauts go up. What's the thing we'll be kicking ourselves over if we didn't do it, right? Be bold. And JD went, sure, I have an idea. Let's do a third of Andromeda. So There's this multicolor picture of a good third of the Andromeda galaxy, so there's like this chunk of the southeastern chunk, all to Hubble resolution. So you've got millions and millions of stars in there. It's really pretty, and you can just keep zooming because there's, you know, still resolution to go. One of the cool things is that you now can identify clusters of stars as individual groupings of stars, not a bright blob in a galaxy where they kind of merge into the next bright blob. You can see like, oh, this is clearly a group of stars. But then you need citizen scientists to go over this giant picture and identify this is a cluster, this is a cluster. Oh, that's a background galaxy. Don't look at those. Only idiots look at background galaxies. This is terrible. And you keep moving, right? And so they go like, oh yeah, that's a background galaxy. So basically, half my career has been following people throwing things in a bin, and I'll go take those. So it's roughly, they've identified 2,500 background galaxies behind Andromeda. For my entire thesis, I, over a 2-year period, identified a similar amount. However, the citizen science group did it in 3 weeks, 21 days, who's counting. They basically did it before Christmas, and we released in November. So, yeah, citizen science is awesome. Like, the sheer power of that, because also, it wasn't just me identifying it. No, it was 150 votes in favor of this thing being a background galaxy. We definitely knew that was a background galaxy. Majority vote said, that's a background galaxy. That's a cluster. So, yeah, that killed the whole idea of counting background galaxies because, you know, somebody did your thesis in 3 weeks. That is, if you're doing a PhD, welcome to science. Somebody will figure out a way to do it in, like, an afternoon at some point. That's okay. That's fine. I've already done my thesis. I don't need to do it again. But it is a good witness of how strong a crowd of people can be. If they work together on a common goal. Another one is people say, like, who has this kind of time? What's an app, remember? So everybody who's just basically standing at waiting for their Uber is just going like, spiral, what's it called? It's nowhere near the amount of time spent playing, for instance, the most popular apps like Angry Birds or something like that. So this came out in 2006. Angry Birds peaked around the same time. Some of you don't even know what Angry Birds is, except for it's a kid's movie, but it is used to be a game, and yeah, there's way more hours spent on Angry Birds than there is on Galaxy Zoo, but you can help now it's called the Zooniverse, because it's not just doing galaxies anymore, it's not just doing astronomy anymore, you can help transcribe war letters from soldiers in the trenches, for example. One of my favorites is that you look at pictures of old ships. Apparently there was a tradition that as a ship came in, they would take a picture of it and note the time, log the time, right? They did this in all kinds of ports throughout the British Empire. So there's these huge logs of pictures of ships and when they came in. You know, super interesting. Actually, we're interested in behind it. There's lots of clouds. So you have data on cloud cover covering 150 years across the globe. Now, weather might be a bit important recently, especially if we have a thing like global warming, and we have an exactly similar problem in global warming. How important are clouds, and how much should I worry about them? Are high clouds a good thing, or are low clouds a good thing? We're only getting to that answer right about now. What the best thing would be is having data. And so having data from 150 or so years from ports around the globe, that'll do. So yeah, there's basically Galaxy Zoo volunteers or Zooniverse volunteers going through pictures of ships coming in and basically looking behind the ship and going, okay, cloud cover is about 2/3. And that's very useful. So eyeballs are good for that. We are extremely good science machines, and as a crowd, we can be amazing. So, I've been in awe of the crowd ever since I got involved with Galaxy Zoo, but I've been using their results ever since. It's quite fun to interact with. They're better at some parts of the science than I do as well, which is really neat. It's like, oh, cool, learn a new thing. So, sorry, that was a really rambling, long answer, but I get really enthusiastic about Galaxy Zoo and, you know, sign up. Have a look. stare at people until they give me a question.
Is that Hubble resolution images of the third of the Milky Way, is that commonly available anywhere?
Yep. Hubble is a public domain program. Anyone in the world can use the data after a certain amount of time. And the fat, I love this, like the panchromatic Hubble Andromeda Treasury. That was not a tertiary acronym at all. So the FAT survey is completely available. You can download the catalog, you can download the images. It has 8 filters, so if you like stars, you can model these stars, you can model how much dust there is in front of them. It is a remarkable achievement. It's kind of pushing the boundaries of how big of an image you can put in a computer at the time. Turns out that a few terabytes is not what most a few terabyte JPEG is not what most computers are counting on. So, I get these really enthusiastic messages from JD. So, like, I broke my computer again. It's like, good, great. So, any more questions? Any more ideas? You can go to zooniverse.org and sign up and have a look. There's lots of biology, and the most recent thing I saw was Serengeti. So you actually stare at a piece of the Serengeti on a real-time camera and see what kind of wildlife comes by. So that sounds dull, but again, maybe you don't have anything better to do as you wait for class or whatever. Or maybe you don't have anything better to do in class. Sorry, I didn't say that. But it is the kind of thing that is very zen to kind of what's like, ooh, giraffe, you know, that kind of thing. Individually, that doesn't tell you much. But again, if you know where the camera is, and how often an animal goes by, you can start to figure out how many of them there are, or for instance, how many meerkats are living in the area, or there's a birding equivalent where people, well, all kinds of enthusiasts basically call in what kind of birds they sell where and when. Individually, that's nice, but compiled together, you suddenly see migration patterns, whether or not, like, oh, look, the Canadian goose is coming down south and basically never moving, so they're never going back to Canada, so why call them Canadian? But anyway, there's these patterns that you can see if you have many eyeballs on it, and I cannot overemphasize how powerful this is, especially just watching this going like, I've done this individually, I thought I was good at it, but it turns out if I give it to a crowd of people, they beat me by a factor of 20. That's not a small margin. Like, they are way better at it. And so, yeah, ask a bunch of people for help is a very good scientific process. Plus, we actually now have a consensus on things, so that was also very nice. We're still mining this.
Just a comment. I find it very interesting that we all receive the great power of computers. But you have images that can crack the computer, and you have discrimination that has to be done by human beings.
So,
or at least some of it has to be done by human beings.
Turns out, yeah, this is way ahead of its time. But now you're talking to computer science people, and they go, wait, you have 300,000 images with classifications to them, and no issues with privacy, no issues with private data, nobody cares if we dispose that like a machine learning program, we're not accidentally, I don't know, driving over people because they're we misclassified, there's no, like, I'm not sure if there's no harm, but it is kind of like, this is the most harmless data set that I can unleash machine learning on without accidentally leaving patient data on a USB stick in the pub or something like that. So it's a very good way, because you have answers from actual eyeballs, that this is a spiral galaxy. So if I want to go and train an algorithm, or I want to see how good we do, we have an answer to compare to. So the biggest thing for machine learning people is go, it's a big black box. and you throw a whole bunch of images on one side, say the family photo album, and at the other end comes, well, these are all the pictures of your daughter. And you're like, well, if I want to check that, I have to literally check every picture in there. And part of the reason why I want to do that is because there's a million of them. I don't know if anybody else has like this problem with their family picture album since iPhones have been involved, but I swear there's a couple of days that my daughter wasn't pictured in a picture by me, but other than that, there's like orders of magnitude more, and if I want to check that, there's no good answer. I don't know how to check it. But now I have a thing that I can check against whether or not how good I did. And I understand what, you know, the black box is actually doing. Because don't let machine learning people tell you otherwise. They have no idea what's happening inside. Right? I've looked into this. So astronomers are getting quite excited about the machine learning thing because, again, we're going to get way more pictures soon. And then how well can we trust this? Is this a once-off? Is this something that we can reproduce? Is this something that we have to be careful with? And again, as a society, I think we also should be very wary of anything that's a black box where magic goes in, magic happens inside, and the right answer comes out on the other end. We need to understand that a little bit better, I think. So before we buy the Amazon, you know, wish list that it made for us based on where we went, So, machine learning is a very useful tool, and so the next thing for Galaxy Zoo is actually a machine hybrid. So, think of, I'll take the example of, I'm classifying pictures of, that's my daughter, that's a random play kid, that's my daughter, that's another random kid, in the various pictures of school and, you know, as I'm following around. How do I train something to do that? Well, it basically follows around and looks at all the data and says, well, that pink blob in that picture, you said it was your daughter, and there's three more very similar looking pink blobs on the same day, so I'm assuming that those are also your daughter as well. You can do the same with galaxies. Oh, this is an elliptical galaxy? Great. Actually, there's five more almost exactly like it. I'll classify them the same way. That speeds things up by a lot. And so we're looking at that kind of thing for instance, for the next Galaxy Zoo iteration. So it's kind of like a machine assistance. And I don't think we should ever accept more than assistance from machines, but, you know, that's my private attitude. So yeah, wow, we just kind of dove into like a complete rabbit hole there. That is something that Galaxy Zoo can be very useful for. So machine learning is a thing. Anything else? Very good question. So awesome. Like, I totally went off on that. So I like it. Anybody else? Questions? Comments? You should talk slower.
Questions are fascinating.
Yeah, but linear stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So I'll try to keep to that.
Right. We get more with digress.
Okay. Well, that's what the cup is for, and the beer. So.
Can I throw in one at the end? So what's the redshift range you cover with your overlapping galaxy?
Can you repeat your question? So what's the redshift range? How deep, how far do you look with these overlaps? So first, the Galaxy Zoo doesn't look very far, because people get bored. And if we show them tiny little blobby things, which is what most of the universe pictures are made of, everybody will get incredibly bored with the app and leave. And if we've learned one thing from citizen science, if you make a terrible app, if you make a terrible experiment, then they will stop. They will leave, and they will never come back. So don't bore your audience is part of the issue. And so we've put in a fairly local limit so that the galaxies at least have something to show. Now, we want to ask what the something is, but otherwise you just go blob, 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 another blob, and it's just not interesting. So it's a fairly close by. It's redshift 0.07. And then I actually ramped it down a little more as well, so that I could actually see great detail with Hubble. So I'm only looking at the very nearest.
But then you also have to live with that you do not consider any part of the evolution of the galaxy you study.
I bigger telescope for me. which is the Bar telescope. So yeah, no, I think we can do this at higher redshift. I've tried. Hubble simply doesn't have the resolution. JWST won't have either. But you can do this.
But that is the holy grail question. Is dust composition in galaxies evolving over time? And does the the high redshift universe look exactly the same when it comes to dust like here? Which
yes.
is everyone hoping for, because then they can just treat it like, yeah, okay, we know how it works, throw it up.
Problem is that I'm going to give the very astronomer answer, I need a bigger telescope for that. I try to avoid that answer whenever I give a public talk, but honestly, that I always end up going like, no, I need a bigger telescope for that. And so not only do I need a bigger telescope for that, I need a bigger telescope in space for that. So, you know, make it 10 times expensive to spend. But yeah, Hubble doesn't have the resolution to do that at any kind of distance. James Webb has roughly the same resolution, so it barely will do any better. To do that, you need a 15-meter, so bigger than this building, mirror. And so then you have the trouble of how do you origami that entire mirror into a rocket, because none of those things are 15 meters across. So think James Webb, but on steroids. Everything is like folded four times so that it all kind of folds out like a flower. Sure, I might be alive when that launches. If I live very healthily, that's going to be a long-term plan.
Would it help to go sub-millimeter, round-based, armor?
Sure, yes, in part. Because again, then you're assuming that your model of how stuff lights up is the same everywhere. And that's the main thing. Like, you don't quite know, and you can never constrain between what it's made of and what temperature it is. And those are two things that you can never distinguish with ALMA. And you need something like this to go like, oh, the composition is different. But maybe with some of the extremely large telescope on Hawaii, for example, or the TMZ, the 30-meter telescope on Hawaii, for example, you might be able to do something like that. That's another thing. I need a much bigger telescope, yeah, so sorry I said it, but that's how all these things end.